such sights to show you.
Yep, okay.
Should we go?
Yeah, it's recording. So.
Oh, fuck, okay.
Our coffee discussion is now immortalized.
I'm sorry, I'm just a little peeved off about this lack of ginger syrup. So you it's fine.
I think you'll survive.
I'm getting over it slowly, yeah.
I'm also...
The fuck was that?
Probably one of my cats.
Oh.
Being a gremlin.
Good transition, yay.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. With me, as always, is my wonderful data tired out.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Fuentes.
I'm wearing a tiki shirt today because we're getting tiki drinks right after this.
Yeah,
and
so.
And I hurt my wrist writing this episode.
So he has a wrist guard. He's wearing a tiki shirt. He looks like a dad. It's really fun.
I didn't shave much this week, so I'm a little scraggly.
It's actually very endearing. But...
Oh, yay!
I was not saying it in a bad way.
No, I know. It's a comparison I haven't had before. Everybody tells me I look all young, so now I'm like, what?
Again, the facial hair does good things for that.
Yeah,
so.
That's true.
Anyway.
We're covering a good one, guys. We're covering a really good one that Alex hadn't seen prior to this.
No, I've never seen this. I know it's an iconic, you know, movie.
It's a classic.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a pop culture kind of icon.
Yeah.
A lot of people have made references to this movie. I'm very excited to be covering it. I think
I'm so glad you got to finally watch it.
Yes.
But I've been watching this again since I've had memories. I've known this movie.
Right.
Like, since way, way early.
And I think that's so cool. Yeah, no, this is... And it's so funny when it came out, too, but we're going to talk about it. But we are talking about 1984's Gremlins.
Gremlins! Holiday season, everybody! Yeah! Ooh. Christmas!
Yes.
A very good horror Christmas movie.
It's a very good horror Christmas movie. This is such a good palate cleanser to fucking Videodrome.
Yeah. Even though they both have graphic violence, this is like a different creature graphic violence.
Very graphic, yeah.
Yeah, which is weird. And that there's some scenes in particular I'm like, this is an R-rated scene. Like for sure.
Maybe.
Like the one with the gremlin in the tree and the mom.
That was fun.
Yeah, but I
was
like,
terrifying.
The angles they're using, I'm like, Jesus,
a lot of the angles, I did want to talk about that. I don't know if that's something that was brought up, but a lot of the angles in this movie, I was just like, they're very unsettling.
Unsettling, yes. Very unsettling.
It's very Spielberg-y.
Oh, yeah, definitely. If Spielberg had a lot more edge, for sure. But that's why you have Joe Dante.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, IMDb synopsis. A boy inadvertently breaks three important rules concerning his new pet and unleashes a horde of malevolently mischievous monsters on a small town.
Yeah. I mean, that's the gist of it.
Way to go. IMDb did not bad with the alliteration and everything there. Okay.
No, yeah, that's true. Malevolently mischievous monsters.
That was a hard one to get through. I think I fucked up mischievous, but whatever, we're good.
No, mischievous.
Anyways, this was written by somebody that didn't do a lot of horror movies, but is ultimately very successful, who's the main focus on this podcast episode, Chris Columbus, who, if you don't recognize that name, don't worry. By the end of this, you definitely will. and is directed by somebody who we've actually covered here.
Yes.
Briefly during a very tragic episode that we did.
Yeah.
But it's director Joe Dante. So this is a Joe Dante's film. This is starring Zach Galligan, who I don't remember in much besides this and maybe some TV work. Phoebe Cates, who's fucking hot.
Yeah.
I love her.
She's so pretty. Like, the whole time I was just watching the movie, I'm like, wow.
Yeah, dude. Okay, and, like, she had this different reputation back in the day as, like a raunchy, like, not good girl. Mm. But, again, I've known this movie since I had memories, so I didn't have that reputation.
Yeah.
So I've only known her as the girl from Gremlins, who I fucking loved with all my heart as a child.
Just wow,
yeah.
She's dreamy.
And then people keep talking about her in like other films. I'm like, she did what scenes? and it also has Hoyt Axton.
That's a fucking great name,
yeah.
By the way. I saw his name in the credits. I'm like, that's an amazing name. Like, Hoyt is a great name, and then Axton is a great name. Like, just together,
yes.
I'm just like, wow, that's a good one.
That's the first. Hoyt is the baby Pokemon, and then he evolves into an Axton. and then Polly Holiday, which is that's a good name too, actually.
Yeah.
Good, yeah. And then Francis Lee McCain.
These are great names. These are all Hollywood names.
These are good. I know, Spielberg-y kind of names for sure.
Definitely.
This one was budgeted at $11 million, which was still kind of higher than Spielberg wanted to, but low, still at the low end for the time. Released on June 8th, 1984.
What a wonderful summer film.
Yeah, exactly, right? Oh, we're going to get into that one also. And then it grossed $153.1 million.
Damn. I think this is like the first like solid success we've covered in like a minute.
In season two? Yeah, maybe since our first episode of
maybe
season two.
Maybe since September.
Scream 2. Yeah, since Scream 2. This is like the first phenomenon we've done again. But this all starts, of course, with the little idea that came to the mind of a certain writer, future writer-director, actually. So, Alex, let us know what happened, how this whole film got started.
Well, right, kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
So, future writer/director Chris Columbus didn't have the easiest path. He was the son of a coal miner and factory worker, and his interests were always geared towards stories and storytelling. Looking back, he says, quote, "I grew up with very little, but the only things I cared about were books, comics, and movies, which were relatively cheap entertainment back then."
Oh, I empathize a lot with this. Yeah. Like, a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, books were a huge, you know, huge form of escapism for me mm-hmm. as a kid. So.
And then working class family, you know, it's one of those things mm-hmm. where you're like, but I like these things.
Yeah. He always had a fascination with New York because all of his favorite comic characters lived there. It was this kind of magical place for him, and he wanted to write for Marvel when he grew up.
Oh,
that's such like a yeah.
It's kind of adorable.
I can relate.
Like, yeah, same here. No,
you
for
know,
sure.
Like not so much with like the big city type of stuff because, I mean, I ended up moving to a bigger city when I was really young. Mm-hmm. But like reading books about like really whimsical small towns where like everyone knew everyone and people like there were like generations of families mm-hmm. that grew up like in the same place, like that was something that I wanted because I'd moved around so much as a kid.
Oh dude, I always wanted the city. Like I'd moved around in non-city areas really, except, you know, Orange County for a little bit,
right.
Obviously, and like Inland Empire is not, it's a city-ish. But like I've always like dreamed of like the big city, you
well,
know?
Now, you know, you live now in like, I do. The now core I do. Of Los Angeles.
Yeah, exactly. But it was the same kind of thing. Like I was always watch TV and whatever it is, and people are out like, oh, we're in these big old New York or LA, whatever it is, and I'm like, oh, wouldn't that be so cool?
Scared the shit out of me. Well, I didn't really, but like, you know, when I moved to San Diego when I was 11.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. You had that exposure there. You're like, hey, not for me.
I'm good. So he then learned that a thing called film school existed.
Ooh.
And he switched his ambitions from comic book writer to filmmaker.
That's a pretty good transition.
I mean, it's a great way to kind of narrow what your goals are and be mm-hmm. like, okay, this is kind of what I want to do. This is kind of like the pipe dream version. And then here's the realistic thing that I can actually accomplish.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So everything seemed great at first. He graduated high school in Warren, Ohio, with a full scholarship to NYU Tisch.
I never know how to say it.
Okay.
Never know how to say it.
Sorry if I'm like someone screaming at their fucking like phone. I'm sorry. School of the Arts.
With an NYU sweater.
Yeah. Like. Sorry. His parents were very supportive of his grand ambitions, and the rest of his family told him he would fail. And he would be back home working in a factory within 2 years.
Oh, pieces of fucking shit,
that's
dude.
Shit.
Nah.
Columbus was determined to prove them wrong.
Yeah, I actually was listening to an interview with him with a New York studio, and he specifically said, like, yeah, I wanted to succeed so I can tell them all to fuck themselves.
Yeah.
Like, that was his big
mean,
thing.
I mean, spite is a fantastic motivator.
It really is. And, like, to tell you, like, hey, yeah, whatever your dreams are, you'll be back here with us, you dumb. Like, that's mean.
Yeah, that's
mean.
Yeah. And that just goes to show, like, you know, how, like, fucked up their lives are.
Exactly.
And how, like, sad and lonely they are in their own lives.
Yeah, they
like,
would rather have him miserable than succeed.
Yeah.
Like, that's fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So this young lad fell in love with film at NYU, even more so than he already had previously. He was finally able to have intense discussions about films with fellow students, something he said was impossible to find back in Ohio.
Oh, yeah. In
so
that
he
interview.
Was like, mm-hmm. he was amongst his people.
Dude, like, yeah, when he talked about this era, he was like jazzed. He was like, I never got to say that to anyone back then. But he was, like, learning from other people because, you know,
right.
they're from all over the world.
Well, and also, like, you know, I think one of the things that I loved about college was I always learned most mm-hmm. from those really fun, intense conversations that I had with my classmates.
Absolutely.
Like, and it was always fun.
And it was also a cool thing because I remember I was like, I wouldn't say I'm smart, but I was relatively above the grade when I was back home. And then I came to college and I'm like, I'm dumb.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa, these guys are way better than, and younger, and holy shit.
Yeah.
So it was nice. And then, you know, once you get over that hurdle, you're like, oh, but now I have other things in my personality that contributes, which is nice. So it's a good... guys, go to college.
I'm glad you were able to do that, because I struggled with, like, gifted kid syndrome for, like, I don't know, the first, I don't know, maybe 3 years of my college career. So I really was only able to enjoy my last year.
Oh, see, I had been beaten down by life because I transferred. So,
well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the pros and cons, I guess, of immediately going to a four-year university, but...
But that's the thing. University, you realize that there are other people like you, and you're like, holy shit, okay, yeah. I was not as unique as I thought I was. Goddamn.
No. Yeah.
But it's
cool.
Well,
also having, you know, spending your whole life with, like, you know, kids or adults your whole life as a very tiny child telling you that you're the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't do... Like, if you are a teacher, like, doing that is not a good thing to do to a student ever.
No, what you should be doing is encouraging hard work. That's you know, yeah, they're smart, whatever, but to be like, hey, also work really hard, because
yeah,
smart kids get lazy. They just do. It
like,
happens.
I knew in college the dumbest people who got the highest grades because they were good test takers, and I was the shittiest test taker.
Yeah, bad too. Yeah.
And so, but it's just like, tests are horrible for dictating intelligence, mm-hmm. and it's just like, ugh.
You gotta learn how to put in the work. That's right.
That's what I'm saying, though. It's like, there are people who are, like, putting in hours upon hours of work,
mm-hmm.
and then still doing average in classes, and then people who aren't working at all, and then still getting, like, the highest, setting the curve, because they're just really good test takers.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's a good encounter to the real world.
It drove me nuts in college. This is, like, such a throwback to university.
This is why I wanted to put this story in here.
He was actually schoolmates with Charlie Kaufman and Alec Baldwin, and had all accounts been doing well.
Yeah, he was doing pretty good for his first year, and he had some pretty big time roommates. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
He met his future producing partner also while doing a bar tour on his first day on campus. But unfortunately, he would slip up.
He slipped up pretty bad, yeah.
So all it was a few missed signatures, and his time at NYU had nearly come to an end. He had missed the deadline to renew his scholarships, and the prestigious New York University was notoriously expensive to attend.
Yep.
This has happened. Anyone who has fought with the financial aid office at their university understands this. Columbus had no choice but to return back home to Ohio, where he got a job for the night shift at an aluminum factory, an experience that nearly destroyed him. Yeah.
Yeah. That'll do it.
So he remembered an early bit of wisdom, quote, don't ever do a job you hate.
Yeah, that came from his dad.
Yeah.
That was one of the things his dad told him, was like, just don't do a job you hate. Like, go to school, do your thing, don't do a job you hate.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, really, his parents loved him.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
They wanted him to succeed, right?
Absolutely.
So during his night shift, he would start work on a script called Jocks to keep his creativity flowing.
Yeah.
Which, at least he was able to find ways to, like, keep his sanity, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that helped out a lot.
Yeah. So, on the experience, Columbus stated, quote, writing between giant rolls of aluminum, hiding from my foreman, it was pure incentive to get the hell out of there, unquote. Mm-hmm. Which, get it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
This aluminum job gave him just enough pay for another year of school, but the factory awaited when the money ran out.
Yep.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, good old American schooling system, huh?
I fucking hate
it.
Well, also, I mean, thinking about it then versus now, like, you couldn't work in a factory just to pay for a year at NYU.
You can't do that even anymore. No.
And that's what I'm saying. You can't do that now.
Exactly.
Like, I'm saying you could probably work at that factory for, like, 5 years and maybe afford, like, a semester.
Exactly. And even then, for this, him, with, like, that small Ohio, like, town wage right there, like...
Yeah.
Compared to other places, it's not that great either. So it's like, the system's pretty fucked.
It's horrible.
It's so bad. Yep.
It was during this time that he had given his Jocks script to a professor for review, who promptly turned it over to his agent and landed Columbus $5,000, enough to pay for the rest of his schooling. And to top it all off, this agent was now getting him offers while he was still in school.
Dude, that professor came in the goddamn clutch right there.
Yeah. No, I Yeah, jeez. Like, I knew professors like this in college who were just like, when they found a student, that they were just like, you have it.
Yeah,
like they,
exactly.
You know, and they wanted to work with that student and see them succeed, especially when they were going through shit like this.
Exactly.
Like,
saw a little bit of themselves in them. And like, yeah, let's, come on.
So, Columbus was given enough work to survive in New York City right out of college. But he always knew that should he slip up again, the factory was not far behind. And then came the onset of a drought.
It was during this time of uncertainty, he actually had one of those aforementioned intense film discussions with a friend. And they both came to a very weird sudden realization. No one was making monster movies anymore. Like, this genre had died out.
What time?
Early 80s.
I mean, slashers was like
slashers was king. Exactly. So, yeah, monster movies were kind of on the way out. The last one was The Blob. The Blob remake, I believe. Was it The Blob? And then the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which I definitely want to cover. You ever seen that?
No.
Oh, that shit's awesome. My grandma used to watch it.
We put it on the
our master list.
No, it's not on our master list. When we did Tucker and Dale versus Evil, one of the posts that we posted was like comedy horror spectrum.
That's right.
And we put Attack of the Killer Tomatoes on there, and I was just like, this can't be a real movie. It's like, put it on there.
It's a real movie. Okay, fans, if you guys want to hear an episode on that at some point, let us know. Anyways.
I think Anthony would be thrilled to do an episode on it.
I would be so thrilled. But that same night that he had this discussion, Columbus was lying down in his New York apartment when he heard rats scurry between the floorboards above him. The rats actually fucking terrified him. But when he started applying that fear to a monster movie, he came up with the idea for Gremlins.
Nice.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what if these rats were creatures? What if they were malicious creatures? And it just kind of spiraled from there. So with this idea in mind, he actually spent 6 weeks turning it into a full feature-length script, written as a spec without knowing if it could even get made. He didn't try to commercialize it at all. He just had a story.
Right.
He wanted to put it to page. He finally brought it to his agent, and he said it was dark. His agent thought it was fucking dark.
Of course.
Not marketable, nothing. He sent it to 50 producers anyways. You know, he's a good agent. So, good for him.
Good job.
Yeah. They all turned his ass down. All except one.
Oh, I wonder who it could be.
Yeah. Well, a certain Steven Spielberg was leaving his office on a Friday when he happened up on a script that was sitting on his assistant's desk. It was very obviously Chris Columbus's Gremlins. And he actually found himself hooked. In the director's mind, this was one of the most original ideas he'd read since his time in Hollywood.
Well, I mean, it's such a, like, yeah, it's a unique concept. I mean,
it is,
And he, like, what I love about this, how this script got made was that Chris Columbus saw that there was, like, that Hollywood was lacking a certain, like, something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he applied that based on something that he was experiencing in his real life and then just fleshed it out until he got fucking Gremlins.
Yeah, a genius move.
But
yeah.
And it's all completely original, which is also one of those things that, like, I sorely miss in Hollywood right now.
It's like lightning in a bottle. Like, straight up. It's like a deficiency in the market.
Yeah.
Right there, a little gap. And then Columbus, like, with actual genuine fear and turning it into something without even a mind to it being commercial.
Yeah.
Which is fucking, again.
Which you don't get as much now because everyone's trying to fill that gap in the market, in the film industry right now. So everyone's trying to make everything. So it's really hard to find what's missing in the industry now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because everyone's trying to remake it. Or then they always have the experience of like, oh, well, this flopped. Like, for example, monster movies. Mm-hmm. Like, anytime they try to redo a monster movie, they just go back to the original, like, when they did, like, the, like, Frankenstein
remake. Don't you remember this? You remember that?
And then it completely flops because it's a shitty fucking idea and it's executed poorly.
Well, yeah. They're all assembly line shit at some point.
And then at that point, no one wants to do it anymore. So then it's just like, well, where are we at now? And
exactly. We need more mid-budget movies. Like, that's where originality comes from.
Yeah.
And every blockbuster has to have some freaking marketing person sign off on plot point and, you know, this will get the kiddies in the seats. All that bullshit. But, you know, at this time, not necessarily. So Steven Spielberg bought this script right away. Like, right away.
Of course.
Yeah, if it's one of those, you know, him, originality, he's like, I'm going to turn this into something. He actually called Chris Columbus directly, who actually thought it was a joke.
I mean, I would too.
Yeah, no, his roommate was straight up, dude, somebody says he's Steven Spielberg, who's on the phone for you. No, this actually happened, and Columbus was like, fuck, okay, dude, I'll take it, but like, whatever, and it was Steven fucking Spielberg. So he
no,
was like,
this
oh,
is actually
shit.
Steven
yeah,
Spielberg.
Yeah, hey, asshole, what's up? Steven Spielberg, okay. Hi, Mr. Spielberg. Anyways.
God, that's also something that's like straight out of a fucking movie.
Yeah, for reals, right? So by 1982, he was working with Mr. Steven Spielberg in L.A.
Ah.
He'd made it from New York to Los Angeles.
Ooh.
Yeah, good for him. So the script obviously needed to be toned down, though. Something the producers were very adamant about. And they needed to find a director that could actually pull off such a unique script. And Steven Spielberg had an idea for a young upstart who had been a former Disney animator and just finished the short film Frankenweenie.
Oh, yes.
Yes. But alas, Tim Burton was not destined to direct Gremlins, as he had, at this point, not done a full feature film. So Spielberg was forced to pass.
Oh, what would that have been like?
It would have been interesting. I honestly would have loved that, too.
What, Tim Burton's fucking
if it was
Gremlins?
If it was his debut, he would have been hungry, man. That would have been
can you imagine
Burton.
Tim Burton's Gremlins? Like, come on.
Dude, I don't even know. Like, I don't know. That's hard to say what the creatures would look like and all this shit. Because the script is still very dark.
I'm just imagining the script of Gremlins taking place in, like, the same town that, like, Edward Scissorhands took place in.
Yeah, like, hyper-stylized,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Like comparatively. Super monochromatic, mm-hmm. super, like, pastel and, like...
Very stilted kind of acting.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Very, like, super Americana. Like, this is mm-hmm. super, super Americana, but, like, not as, like, you know, not as on the nose
as exactly.
Tim Burton. And is known to be
no definitely that makes sense. It would have been different.
It would have been different.
Way different.
I would have loved to seen it, but I also of course love this one. But yeah. Oh my gosh, Tim Burton. Oh my god, I can't even imagine.
I know, but Spielberg had to pass. He didn't have the credentials yet.
Of course, yeah.
He would get them a year later.
Get them later.
Yeah, literally 1 year after this got released.
I didn't know Tim Burton used to be a Disney animator.
Yeah, no, he used to work directly with Disney before the Renaissance period. Mm. So yeah, but he was a little too dark for Disney.
What?
Yeah, he actually was. He got fired.
Wow.
We can cover that.
Well, we're going to go into it.
Yeah.
Eventually, maybe.
I know. We'll see. But alas, again, Tim Burton wasn't destined. Spielberg needed a director that knew, though, how to balance horror and comedy. That was a big deal to him. And also somebody who actually had some technical talent to deliver the special effects needed for this script, which nobody knew how they were going to do it. They just knew that they had to have these creatures.
Yeah.
So Steven Spielberg actually then found his director by a viewing of a film called The Howling, which we haven't actually covered
no.
yet. And he knew that director for this film had to be Joe Dante.
Yes.
Yeah. Who
have we done any werewolf movies?
Not yet. We could probably put it on the list, huh?
Probably should at some point.
Okay, at some point, guys, you're getting a werewolf movie anyways. Not the Landis one, though.
We're
or
not
we
doing
could, so we could talk shit on it.
I mean,
I don't
we
know.
Could
we'll
do
see.
American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
I do. American Werewolf in Paris is also kind of fun. So.
Yeah, that's true. We can get
maybe
around
maybe do
the
a
Landis
double
stuff.
Feature.
Yeah, there you go. That'll make it easier. So he had actually settled upon Joe Dante. He truly believed that he would be the one, based off the effects work in The Howling, to be able to bring this concept to life. And he sent a script over to Dante's office right away. Now, what happened, Alex? Let us know.
So, director Joe Dante was down to his last few dollars when he received the script for Gremlins.
Ooh, that
yeah.
sucks.
He thought maybe it was sent to the wrong address.
Yeah, this is a theme going on here.
Yeah.
Huh?
Steven Spielberg, okay.
Yeah. Spielberg's on the 40, okay, assistant.
The company that had produced The Howling conveniently went out of business before they could pay him for his work.
Fucking assholes, dude.
He was a successful Hollywood director, but was nearly in ruin. But many in Hollywood knew that horror comedy was to be the next big thing, even if Dante didn't at the time.
Yeah, this is one of those things the producers were like, the numbers are saying we got to make more of these movies, but the talent was like, where do I find a job?
He, of course, accepted the offer from Spielberg, coupled with a bit of added pressure. This was going to be Amblin Entertainment's follow-up to E.T.
Damn.
And the first film to feature the legendary logo.
Yeah, this is going to be the flagship film after E.T.
So it had to be good.
Yes.
Yeah. So the first thing everyone did was tone down the script significantly so that parents could actually take their kids to see the movie.
Yeah, they tried to.
Yeah. Originally, it was Gizmo, or the character in place of Gizmo, that was going to turn into Stripe. But Spielberg felt that the character should be turned into a sidekick, and this change transformed the story completely. This is such a good choice.
I agree. This is a good choice.
Gizmo, I don't know if we're going to talk about it, but Gizmo has such, like, Baby Yoda energy that I just want to, like, hold Gizmo forever.
Okay, yeah, no, Gizmo was, like... OG. Again, I've known this movie since forever.
Right.
So I fucking used to love Gizmo. And my little sister's nickname growing up was Gizmo.
That's so cute.
Yeah, because she was so tiny. You should see it. I'll show you a picture of her, but she was literally Gizmo.
Oh, like, that's adorable.
Yeah, as a little baby.
But oh my gosh. But But Gizmo's adorable and was my favorite in the whole movie. Anytime I saw Gizmo, I was just like,
cute. Good design. Good design.
Yeah, really good design. So Joe Dante thought this film was going to take 5 years to make.
And this is an expert opinion. He was like, with the special effects we have right now, whatever, we can get this film done in 5 years. That was his
mind.
Yeah.
So it was during these early stages that Joe Dante also took on the task of directing the It's a Wonderful Life segment of Twilight Zone, the movie, which please revert to that episode if you would like to listen to some super fucked up shit.
Mm-hmm. But also our opinions on the It's a Wonderful Life segment.
Yeah.
You get both.
So, quote, I would shoot Twilight Zone during the day and do storyboards on Gremlins. During lunch, I would work on the storyboards for Gremlins. So.
Yep. He was working his ass off during this
That's time. Like doing just like a double shift, I guess.
And based on my hand here, I can understand the workaholic over.
He has a little wrist case thing.
And I did it writing this episode for you guys, so.
So, yay. Legitimate pain, blood, sweat, tears has gone into this show.
It's okay. I loved writing this one. So,
it's okay. I think he was more bummed that it hindered him from writing the episode than the fact that he was actually injured.
Yes. I was so mad.
Because we wanted to get this done faster, but it's fine.
I was like, whatever, take 2 days off. Fucking da.
So at some point, the dreaded Twilight Zone incident occurred, and Spielberg was under far more scrutiny than he had ever been used to in his career.
Yep.
So again, refer back to our episode on that film for more information.
Yeah, just as a short, Spielberg was on top of the fucking world, and now he had... very, very, very critical eyeballs on
Now him. He had the entirety of Hollywood up his ass.
Yep.
So, with this added pressure on the studio and the simultaneous production of another horror comedy, Ghostbusters, it was more important than ever for this film to be a hit.
Yep.
Warner Brothers had initially given Gremlins a Christmas release date to capitalize on the theme and give it some breathing room from Ghostbusters and the Temple of Doom, which were releasing in the summer of 1984. Suddenly, and very possibly after smoking crack, Warner Brothers decided to move Gremlins' release date from Christmas 1984 to June 8th, 1984, opening directly against Ghostbusters and only a month after Temple of Doom.
Yeah, it must have been some good crack right there.
It must have been some, like, grade A Hollywood crack.
Seriously, to make that fucking move. But whatever, you know? Cool, it's your studio, Warner Brothers, it's fine.
Joe Dante's 5-year plan was whittled down to a year and a half, and it was time to cast this bitch and get a movie made.
Damn.
That's rough.
I know.
What kind of crack was Warner Brothers smoking?
And how are we still surprised by this, doing this podcast?
We shouldn't be, but it's still dumb. I think we should still continue to be surprised, because that's part of our charm.
Exactly. Phoebe Cates... my future wife, was a controversial choice for this movie. She had appeared naked in her first ever film, Paradise, which is a ripoff of Blue Lagoon. 3 months later, she appeared... oh, and she was 17, by the way, in that movie.
Oh, good, so, good,
yeah,
good.
Yeah,
good.
You know.
Love
you
Hollywood.
Know. Exactly.
Love Hollywood.
Hollywood in the 80s, you know? 3 months later, she appeared topless in the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High, a huge 80s hit.
That's where I've seen her before.
Yeah. It featured, quote, the most memorable bikini drop in cinema history. I believe that was according to Guardian. But it's very commonly referred to as, yeah. Pretty significant scene for 80s teen comedies. Yeah, she became a teen icon, but was always seen as sort of risque. And the studio was not ready for her to headline their attempt at a dark comedy family creature feature. No one really knew how to categorize Gremlins. They just did it.
A dark comedy family creature feature is kind of the best way to describe it, in my opinion.
See, and I wrote that, so yeah, that's how it was. But yeah, I don't know. Nobody really knew what it was, but they knew that, like, okay, Phoebe Cates would add another R-rated element to a movie we're already trying to get children to watch, essentially.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. Spielberg saw something in Cates, and he wanted her for this role. He saw something. He just felt like she was the one that had to be in this movie. The only issue was actually having the right male counterpart to go against her for the lead character, Billy.
Mm.
Yeah, that was the hardest part.
Everyone else is doing the hard work, mm-hmm. and he's just kind of, like, skating through based off of their hard work.
Yeah, he's...
Like, the mom... like, knocks out, like, 4 out of 5 of these, like, bad bitches. And, and then he, like, spends the rest of the movie trying to take out one.
Yeah, exactly. But he's the hero, okay? He's the hero.
Yeah. Explain that to me. God.
Well, names like Judd Nelson and Emilio Estevez were considered for the part. But Spielberg did not have the same certainty with them as he had for Cates.
God, could you imagine Judd Nelson? That would have been hilarious.
I would not have liked that.
You don't like Judd Nelson?
Emilio Estevez, maybe. He would have been...
I mean, Emilio Estevez and Zach Galligan, like, kind of look... have a similar kind of, like, youthful,
teeny
bopper, like, you know, like, popular guy, like, mm-hmm. look.
And then Estevez has a little more confidence, though.
Yeah.
Which I think Zach Galligan does the bumbling kind of, like, hero thing pretty well.
Yeah,
I don't know if
true.
Estevez would have been too competent.
That's true.
But, I mean, he still probably would have been good. Judd Nelson would have been a piece of shit. I don't know. I just have his Breakfast Club character.
I know. I'm like, you are really casting to type here.
I like him, but it's just one of those things where I'm like, ah, dude, I just can't see him. Just can't see him in that role.
When I said, like, can you imagine Judd Nelson, I was imagining, like, transplanting his character from The Breakfast Club into this.
Yeah, punching gremlins in the face and shit.
Yeah, he would have been punching gremlins. He would have been a little bit too happy to set that movie theater on fire.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. But enter Zach Galligan, who was mostly an unknown at the time, actually. He had actually auditioned with Cates in the past, so him and her were pretty comfortable together on the screen. And it actually came out in their screen tests. So at some point during one of their screen tests, Galligan just rested his shoulder or his head on Phoebe Cates' shoulder and looked directly at the camera. Steven Spielberg literally stopped mid-audition and said, quote, "Oh my God, look at that. He's in love with her already. I don't need to see anything else." Yep.
God.
Spielberg knew it. He knew it right then. Later on, Galligan would actually reveal in an interview that he was actually in love with Phoebe Cates.
Of course.
Yeah, he was. He thought she was
God, dreamy. Steven Spielberg. Dude, that's such a dad move. Like, he's just look at him. He's clearly in love with her.
Yeah, look at my son. No, dude, he thought she was fucking dreamy.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because she's dreamy.
She is. She's totally dreamy. But apparently she had a thing for older dudes.
Ah.
Yeah, so Galligan was like, fuck.
Out for the count.
Out. But the rest of the cast was actually filled out with veteran actors. Glenn Turman, who would play the high school chemistry teacher, years after his stint on Peyton's Place, was cast in the role. Dick Miller, who had been working with Dante for a while and has just a long filmography.
Yeah.
I did not want to put that because that shit goes back way, way back. But you recognize him. He's the neighbor.
Yeah.
But he was set to, of course, the neighbor. And he was the first creature actually to refer to the creatures as gremlins.
The first creature to refer to the creatures?
He was the first character to refer to the creatures as gremlins. I'm reading a little fast. Anyways, they actually managed to snag Corey Feldman too, who at the time was known for some TV roles and his work on Disney's The Fox and the Hound. Yeah.
I like that that's all he was known for at the time.
But he was about to have this big push with this movie and a certain Friday the 13th Part 4, which we're going to have to cover eventually.
Yes.
Obviously. We still got to cover Part 3. But yeah, that was going to be his breakout right there. So the film ended up with a great cast. But the cast needed some very convincing special effects to act against, especially for the character of Gizmo. So, Alex, let us know about filming the Gremlins.
Sure. So, Joe Dante made a point to film everything on backlots so the film would feel more like Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, which was also in the movie. Mm-hmm. So that was fun.
Yeah.
And I did notice that it was the Universal backlot.
It was. It totally was. Like, right away, huh?
when he was walking to work, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. I was like, is that the... I'm like, it's the fucking Universal backlot.
And the town's called Hill Valley.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a little on the nose, guys.
No, well, this is before Back to the Future.
Oh.
Yeah, this is around... They're both coinciding with each other.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, no! So, for the voice of Gizmo, Dante enlisted Howie Mandel since he had a baby voice in his catalog of performances. The voice would be sped up in post, but Dante found the effect perfect.
He's got a good eye.
The fact that Howie Mandel is the voice of Gizmo is weird as fuck.
They had Spielberg money.
Right, but I'm just like, it's Howie Mandel. That's just the only thing. Mm-hmm. But for Gizmo's singing voice, tons of professionals auditioned, but it was the simple voice of a little girl discovered by composer Jerry Goldsmith that ended up being the winner.
And we've covered, Jerry Goldsmith also is pretty badass too.
I was gonna say, he's showed up quite a few times, so.
And the music in this movie is awesome.
The ending song, it's so good. So, so good.
And I love Gizmo's song so much.
His little singing, it's adorable.
It just flutters my heart.
It does. So, because the Gremlins themselves took up such a huge chunk of the budget, security was very tight on set. To the point that actors had to have their trucks inspected before going home.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, yikes.
Damn, I know. Open your trunk, sir. is that a Mogwai?
Is that a puppet?
Get the gun.
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, like, that's so wild to me. Like, I mean, I had to do that when I worked at a sex shop. Like, they had to check everyone's bags. Yeah. We were, like, smuggling out the merchandise. I was just like, okay.
Like, why is your bag 10 inches today?
Like, I mean, seriously, shit like that. And I'm just like, okay, here's my bag. Yeah. I would love to leave now.
You guys are paying me, so whatever.
So, speaking of the Gremlins, the first team had no idea how they were going to pull them off. Stop motion was considered briefly, but the team soon realized that they would be shooting well into their release date by the time the stop motion effects would be completed.
Yeah, especially in the 80s, this shit took fucking forever.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Special effects artist Chris Wallace, who had worked with Dante since Piranha, had to bring the creatures from the page to the screen and settled upon a brilliant idea. Monkeys.
Yeah.
Well, monkeys in gremlin suits.
Yeah, not a bright idea, but hey, let's see how it played out.
Sure. The team needed to test this idea, so they brought in a monkey and put him in a prototype suit and let him roam around the editing room. The creature was terrified and pooped everywhere.
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 Everywhere, yeah. No, they did. There was one test is all it took.
And then they learned their lesson.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately, a mix of rubber and mechanical puppets were a far less shitty, literally, alternative. Yeah. And the team found that they actually looked pretty good.
Yeah, better than stop motion for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Still, mm-hmm. technology couldn't make them look completely photorealistic, especially in bright light. To get around this, the creative team developed the no bright lights rule, which allowed them to obscure some of the less polished models.
Smart.
I mean, I love this. This is such fun, like, filmmaking.
Oh, absolutely.
It also gave the film a pretty cool ambiance because most of the film is in really low light.
Yeah, yeah. It actually, I think it set the tone for a Christmas. It makes it really distinctive as a Christmas movie.
I agree,
like,
yeah.
Like, for sure.
So, the Gizmo puppets were also a source of frustration for the crew because of Spielberg's insistence on Gizmo being present for most of the film instead of the original plan of him only being present in the first half. More models had to be designed for Gizmo scenes in the second and third act.
Mm-hmm. More work for the special effects crew, God. Which already had to, like, innovate.
Right. The Gizmo puppets were much smaller, of course, and far more prone to breaking. The crew hated this so much they developed a list of, quote, horrible things to do to Gizmo.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah, they did not like working on this little fucker.
Aww. I mean, it's basically like a little Furby.
Yeah.
Which I understand. Furbies are terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So, as a gift to the special effects... As a gift to the special effects crew, a scene from the list was added to the film where the gremlins hang Gizmo on a wall and throw darts at him.
Yeah, that's why we have that scene. Which was always terrifying to me.
Just to placate the fucking special effects guys who were just like angry at Gizmo.
Like, okay, cut. You guys can have the rest of the darts and just destroy the puppet. It's fine.
Larger puppets were needed for close-ups for both the gremlins and Gizmo, as the regular puppets weren't able to convey the facial emotions needed for certain scenes. Again, these were very new special effects for the time.
Yeah, it took up a pretty big chunk of the budget, so...
Yeah. Mm. And it's a pretty, I mean, it's still pretty low budget, but, you know.
Yeah, but they got some good shit.
I mean, it's an $11 million. I mean, it's still a lot of money. Like, we're still, it's not like pennies
here. I mean, we've covered shit like Halloween, which is like $300,000.
So. I know, this isn't like a $10,000 movie. Like, so, but even with an accelerated shooting schedule and breakthroughs in special effects technology, Joe Dante and his crew managed to make the film they wanted to make. And the studio still didn't quite get it. And not just the studio, but our old dear friends at the MPAA. Let's take a look.
Always fun when we talk about the MPAA, huh?
It's always a fun time.
Always fun. But there was one scene that the studio and even Steven Spielberg wanted to cut. But Joe Dante fought like hell for it. The scene was where Kate tells Billy the story of how her father died.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. Isn't that a fun scene?
It's a Well, okay. I will say... I have to admit, like, as I'm watching this scene, I'm like, this is such a fucked up story. Mm-hmm. And then 2 seconds later, I'm like, I have no idea what the point of this was.
That's why I love it.
There was no point.
Oh, we'll talk about it. It's in the discussion. Don't worry.
Okay. But I'll refrain.
Hold it in. The scene was actually based on an urban legend involving, of course, the dead Santa Claus. The studio and Spielberg didn't know if it was intended to be scary or funny. They didn't know. And the tonal confusion was something they felt would actually put off audiences.
Oh, yeah. It's a hilarious fucking scene.
Right?
It's a joy.
I thought it was funny.
Jesus Christ, Anthony.
I don't know why. I always thought it was kind of funny. But Dante explained it was perfect for the film because the dichotomy between scary and funny was what the film was actually all about.
Sure.
Yeah. He ultimately convinced Spielberg and won the fight. But they actually had another obstacle, as the MPAA did not know how to rate the film. They legit didn't know how to rate the film. At the time, the rating system went from PG straight to R.
Jesus!
Yep, with nothing in between.
Oh, man.
Most of the contention around the rating was the scene where the gremlin explodes inside the microwave. A very graphic scene that towed the line on what was acceptable in a PG film. That one in particular, like, really, they had to argue about this one.
I'm just still hung up on it just went from PG to R.
Yeah, kind of stupid, huh?
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're removed from all
a
this
lot.
Shit. Exactly. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was already receiving complaints from parents who felt that some of the content was just unsuitable for children. But the MPAA felt there wasn't enough graphic material to warrant an R rating, and they did let Gremlins off with a PG.
I cannot believe this movie is rated PG.
It's rated PG, Alex, for sure.
Parental guidance suggested.
Yes. When Gremlins was released for critics, it received generally mixed reception, but not necessarily, you know, that the film was bad. Most critics actually felt that it was a really well put together film. It was exactly that line between horror and humor that threw off most critics, as they felt it was far too violent for what the story itself warranted. Yeah, so on the side in favor of Gremlins was our boy Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, who found the twisted sense of humor to be a major appeal to film.
Yeah.
Especially Kate's Christmas story. On the two controversial scenes, our boy Ebert states in his 1984 review, quote, "Her story is in the great tradition of 1950s sick jokes. I can say words. And as for the microwave scene, I had a queasy feeling that before long we'd be reading the newspaper stories about kids who went home and tried the same thing with the family cats. Ebert yeah. loved this shit. Peter Bradley of The Guardian referred to it as, quote, wacky satirical spectacle of chaos.
Love that.
He loved it too. However, Leonard Maltin. Have you heard of Leonard Maltin before?
No.
He was like a big critic back in the day.
I know.
I used to watch it. I was a little film nerd.
I know. Yeah. And it's, I feel like I'm so behind on everything because I didn't get into this until I was in college. So I'm just like, I don't know. I'm sorry.
No, I was one of those kids that was like, you know, Ebert, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert at the movies and then Leonard Maltin's show afterwards. So yeah, he called the film, of course, icky and gross. Dave Kerr of the Chicago Reader states, quote, Dante is perhaps the first filmmaker since Frank Tashlin to base his style on the formal free-for-all of animated cartoons. He is also utterly heartless. But with mixed reviews, some controversy, and a head-to-head release with the far more acclaimed Ghostbusters, Gremlins is ready to be released. What happened?
Well, before we do that, can I interject some Letterboxd reviews from Gremlins?
Interject it, please. Get him in there.
So, Katie from Letterboxd with 4 stars says, I love how little shits anyone gave in the 80s, and honestly, more children need to die in movies.
A lot of, again, this is our season of child death, apparently.
And then Willow McClay with 4.5 stars.
I love that name.
Says, all Gizmo ever wanted to do was chill out and watch movies. Gizmo spends basically all of his time in Gremlins being so captured in what is on screen during the various movies he decided to watch. So, in a way, everyone on this site is Gizmo. I'd wager a good deal of us react the same way to Sunlight as well. And that makes Gizmo the most relatable movie character of all time for cinephiles. Oh. We are all Gizmo.
Oh, see, I was going to put more Letterboxd reviews, but I was on a deadline because of my fucking wrist.
No, I get it. You know, it's totally fine. But those are those are some of the popular reviews. It also only has 400 reviews, but it sits at a 3.7. rating, with most of them being 4 stars.
Well, there you go. It's honest, it's a very, very big film for a lot of people. Only 400, that's fucking weird.
Oh wait, hold on. Ah, yes, 61,344 ratings.
Okay, see, that makes more sense.
Yeah,
it makes more sense.
400 fans, and then there we go. That makes a lot more sense.
Needs more fans.
So let's get on with the kind of legacy of Gremlins.
Yeah.
So Gremlins was fucking huge.
Huge.
Huge. Gargantuan. Mm-hmm. On its opening weekend, it already recouped its budget with a $12.5 million opening weekend, coming in second place, just $1.1 million behind Ghostbusters.
That's pretty good.
And it's fucking Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
So by the end of its first domestic run, Gremlins would rake in over $148 million. But it wasn't all sunshine, as Gremlins had a few controversies working against it.
Yep. So, of course.
Yeah. First was the accusations of racism from some film scholars who saw the creatures themselves as a negative commentary on black culture. Mm-hmm. This was due to their love of breakdancing, fried chicken, and love of, quote, black music. And the sunglasses / newsboy cap combo some of the gremlins would wear. Then there was the violence. Many parents complained about the graphic violence in the film, with a good amount walking out of the theater with their children in hand before the film even finished.
Oh yeah, that happened a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, I love seeing that happen even now. And I saw Knives Out over Thanksgiving, and this guy brought his kids with him to see Knives Out for some reason.
It's marketed as like a comedy-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, but the first, I mean, I'm not going to say anything about the movie, but the point is it does not have a very family-friendly opening.
Oh, okay.
And then he just walked out with all of his kids. And it was great because they were behind me and they were allowed to shit. And I was just like going to turn around and just yell at them. But I didn't because it was Thanksgiving. I saw it on Thanksgiving. So.
Oh my God. I actually saw that happen for Krampus.
Really?
Yeah. Somebody was like, okay, let's go. Let's go. What's the creature's got
Krampus
all crazy?
Krampus is so good.
It is. It's a very good
movie.
We'll
cover it eventually. Not this Christmas season, but...
But now that I remembered it, yeah.
Yeah, eventually in another Christmas season, we will cover Krampus, because God, such a fun
movie.
That's
a good one, absolutely.
Because of the heavy amount of complaints from audiences about Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the MPAA was in need of a solution. Steven Spielberg had that solution.
He totally did.
A new rating between PG and R to indicate that some pictures are suitable for children, but not others.
For some children. Oh, some children. No,
for
okay.
some yeah. children.
But not other children. Yes.
Some children. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the difference between taking a 7-year-old to see a movie versus taking, you know, a 12-year-old.
Yeah, somebody who, like, understands the world a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the result was the PG-13 rating. Some studios were initially apprehensive about this rating until PG-13 films started making more money than any of the other ratings.
Yeah, yeah. They were a little scared. They're like, well, people wouldn't understand it.
Well, it makes total sense. Because then, like, even me growing up, I mean, obviously in the legacy of this.
Yeah.
Obviously, if they tried to introduce a new rating, like, now, I think mm-hmm. I would still be, like, a little, like, we've covered our fucking bases, yeah. guys.
PG-15, fuck you guys.
Yeah. But,
What's a D rating?
Yeah, I would have no idea, but... I mean, this kind of makes sense because it literally PG straight to R. It's very funny though that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins is what caused the PG-13 rating.
It's this film.
That is so funny,
right? Which is why this is why it took me a little while to write it, because I'm like, oh, I'm actually introducing like a major Hollywood shift.
Yeah,
holy shit.
So the first film with the new rating was 1985's Red Dawn, which is the same year Gremlins was briefly re-released in theaters and added an extra few million to its total gross earnings. Turns out, though, it was a huge fucking hit on home video, giving Spielberg, Joe Dante, and Chris Columbus another huge hit under their belts.
Yeah, dude. Good on fucking home video. Good box office. Created a whole new rating. This is a phenomenon. This is what this was.
Yeah. So Spielberg's Amblin brand would continue to put out hits, as Spielberg's gonna Spielberg, of mm-hmm. course.
Yes.
Fuck. Love Spielberg. Okay. Yeah. So the film spawned several imitators also, such as Critters and Ghoulies, but neither had that Joe Dante touch.
Nope.
Speaking of which, Joe Dante unfortunately had a few flops immediately after Gremlins, but did make a comeback with the dark comedy The Burbs in 1989.
Starring good old Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah. With this hit and the demand for a sequel, Joe Dante would be given complete creative control over the follow-up, Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
Mm-hmm.
The sequel would not be nearly as big a hit as the first film, or a hit at all, really, but we'll cover all of that at a later date. Don't you worry.
Yeah, don't you worry. You'll hear about the sequel to Gremlins for sure. Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen it, obviously, mm-mm. but I
know it's a lot darker, right?
No.
No? Or is it more funny? Or
it's
is it,
way different.
It's just different.
It's different.
Okay.
Yeah. I used to love it. Okay. I loved it. But like...
I know a lot of people didn't though.
Because it's not like the first one for
gotcha.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Which again, we'll cover someday, guys. Don't worry. Don't worry.
So...
Krampus and fucking Gremlins 2.
Next Christmas.
Next Christmas.
Writer slash director Chris Columbus, the former kid from Ohio, had many hits left in him.
Oh, yeah.
His next script, which you might be familiar with.
Maybe.
The Goonies, yes. turned into a major hit and was soon given opportunities to direct films of his own. In 1990, he created another phenomenon and directed the mega hit, another Christmas movie, Home Alone, and became a true box office director.
Dude. Dude. Goonies and Home Alone right after this.
God.
Damn.
He followed up the success with major religious...
the major religion, the Columbus people.
He became a cult leader. And then,
cult leader. That's why so many tickets were bought. Jeez.
Major releases such as Mrs. Doubtfire, 9 Months, Stepmom, and Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Oh, yeah.
So after pretty much defining the 90s, Columbus brought to life one of the biggest children's novel hits in modern history with Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, discovering Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson in the process.
He cast all of Harry Potter.
God damn.
Dude.
Yeah.
That's a fucking career. Macaulay Culkin, cool. Daniel Radcliffe, cool. Zach Galligan, cool.
I mean, all of the Goonies.
Yeah, all of the Goonies, true. Corey Feldman up in that bitch,
yeah, which
too.
Also I was going to say, is because I wanted to mention that, but I didn't want to like get ahead mm-hmm. of ourselves. Because I was like, wasn't Corey Feldman also shortly in the Goonies after
oh, yeah.
this?
Oh, yeah.
But So he defied the expectations of those relatives who told him he was destined to work in a factory and became one of the most profitable directors in Hollywood, promptly earning him the privilege of telling them to go fuck themselves.
Probably. Yeah.
not bad for a film nerd from Ohio, if I do say so myself.
I agree.
So with that, that is Gremlins.
Damn. Don't you love that journey?
That was fun. That was a really good story. Good job, Anthony.
Thank you.
You deserve a pat on the back.
Yay. But yeah, from this little fucker from Ohio who just liked to talk about films and being told they ain't gonna be nothing. And then he Harry Potter.
Yeah, he started the franchise that, like, you know, defined a generation.
He defined childhoods in 3 decades. In the
80s,
in the 90s with Home Alone, and in 2000s with Harry Potter.
I mean, even me, because, like, even me as a 90s kid,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Harry Potter, because, like, I mean, I was, like, aware in the later 90s, early 2000s, so that's when Harry Potter became, like, a thing.
A thing, that's right. But for 3 fucking generations, dude, Gremlins, fucking...
Goonies,
Home Alone, Harry Potter, Mrs. Doubtfire...
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Goddamn, dude. Chris Columbus killed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He earned the right to tell him to go fuck himself.
I mean, and of course, Gremlins.
And of course, Gremlins, which we're talking about right now. But goddamn, dude.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, like, the Goonies, Mrs. Doubtfire, Home Alone, like, all of it. Like, a lot of his movies, I'm just like, wow, he really just did that shit.
Dude. He tried to do it again with Percy Jackson, but it just didn't work out. But I mean,
Percy Jackson was, I mean, that was a lot of other... issues, because that's a really hard concept to adapt to film.
Absolutely. But hey, he had 3 decades.
I say that because I have a bunch of the Percy Jackson books on my book.
Directly to the left of me and to the right of Alex, there are a bunch of Percy Jackson books, obviously.
I'm a big fan of the series, and I really wanted to like the movie, and I tried to like the movie.
Yeah.
Say lovey.
But hey, 3 decades of, like, owning it. Good for him.
Definitely.
Anyways, so, Senorita Webster.
Yes.
What'd you think of the Gremlins for your first time watching it?
I fucking loved it.
Right? I knew you would love it.
I loved it. It was funny. It had, like, the family didn't hate each other.
Yeah.
Like, it was wholesome when it needed to be wholesome. It had scary elements. Like, the special effects were fucking amazing.
Dude, they were so good.
The puppet effect, like, the practical puppeteering was fucking amazing.
Dude, like, almost seamless, right?
Well, I mean, it also was just, it reminded me a lot of, Star Wars, because I've been watching Star Wars, so a lot of, like, this, there's a lot of that similar.
A little bit of overlap there,
That puppet styling. Mm-hmm. Again, also, I've been watching a lot of The Mandalorian, so, like, there's, the special effects for The Mandalorian, they specifically wanted to stylize it like an older Star Wars movie.
Oh, dude.
So.
I still gotta watch it.
Which is why I was just, like, there's a lot of similarities between, like, the baby Yoda and, or as I like to call him, Yodito.
Yodito? Oh, I love that. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. Dude.
Little Yodito.
You're awesome. Hell yeah.
But anyway, so he has that very similar, like, kind of puppeteering movements.
Yeah, that gizmo kind of feel,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it has the gizmo feel, which is why there's a lot of similarities there. And, of course, they're, like, designed and stuff. But also just, like, how they move. Like, it has that kind of feel to it that I really enjoy. It's very nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, yeah, I fucking loved it. Like, I was expecting that I was going to enjoy it, but I did not expect that I was going to enjoy it this much.
No, like, dude, I hadn't watched this movie in, like, 5 years.
Really?
It's been a while. Like,
so
a
was
while.
It was it a nostalgic experience for you?
I want to buy the Blu-ray as soon as I can. As soon as I can find it, I'm getting that fucking Blu-ray.
Because
it's one of those things where I've known this film as much as I've known Consciousness.
Right, you had mentioned that.
But there are shots, like, straight shots of, like, Gizmo's first time singing, the first time the Mogwai is revealed, things like that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize were just so important to me, because I had known them since fucking forever. So when I saw them again, it was like
a tugging,
dude,
at the heartstrings.
It just got me, like, I was like, because I used to just put it in. Like, straight up, just like, oh, cool. We're watching E.T. today, we're watching Land Before Time, we're watching The Gremlins, we're watching, like Beauty and the Beast. Like, I would slap these movies in.
So when did you watch Gremlins, like, the first time that you remember?
Don't know. I just don't
That's
know.
That's such a graphic movie to have, like, seared into your consciousness.
Yeah, I don't know. Good old Mexican horror-loving family, you know? Yeah. It reminds me of my grandma, the one that likes the horror movies.
Yeah.
Like, this kind of movie she would put on for us. And I would just be like, you know, my grandma Linda. Like, she'd babysit us and we'd watch it like this. But, like, I loved Gremlins so much.
Well, it's so funny because, like, I've also seen so many I don't want to say parodies, but like offshoots of Gremlins where people are trying to duplicate.
Trying to emulate a little
bit. Emulate mm-hmm. the feel of it where mm-hmm. it's just like, okay, these little creatures, and then they turn into something not so cute and cuddly.
Yeah.
So of course, Ghoulies and Critters and mm-hmm. like that kind of stuff that we mentioned earlier. But so that was very fun.
Right? Yeah. And to me, I feel like actually Krampus is the only one that kind of does the same style. Like, it does that, like, that kind of has the Gremlins look to it a little bit with some very good practical effects.
I've actually only seen Krampus once, and it was in theaters.
Yeah, so.
So I need to rewatch it, but I do remember just, that was the one, that was, I think I had the experience that a lot of people, moviegoers, had watching Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
I had watching Krampus, because I went into it thinking it was going to be way more, like, I'm trying to remember my thoughts going into it, but I remember being confused sitting in the theater because I'm like, is it a comedy? Is it a horror film? Like, it's because it's so dark. Krampus is such a dark movie, but it goes into like an actual like contemporary horror place.
Yes, it absolutely does.
But it's so fucking funny.
And it's very kind of cheery in the beginning.
Exactly.
Well, not cheery, but like, you know, kids movie, it could be.
Right, but what I'm saying is, like, it has, like, I can only assume, because I did not grow up in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
that it was a similar experience that I think, in terms of special effects and, like, what I am used to in terms of severity, because it was so graphic
mm-hmm.
and so funny.
Yeah, that's this movie, too. Yeah.
Right, but, like, and then also in the context of it being in the 80s, I can imagine people going to see Gremlins and being like, this is so graphic.
Like, what the fuck?
But so funny.
Take my money and make $130
million. Right, and of course now, watching it, I'm like, okay, this isn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I think seeing it in the 80s, it would be a very similar experience.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, I had that experience watching Krampus, because I was expecting, I'm like, okay, it's a horror comedy, it's gonna be mm-hmm. funny, it's gonna have some scary moments, but it was like on both ends of the spectrum simultaneously. Like, it was super funny, but also terrifying.
Yep, definitely. And this is the same kind of shit.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I never would have made that connection.
Well, and to think too, during the time, this is the second Amblin movie.
Yeah.
The first one was E.T. E.T. wasn't graphic. E.T. just had cool special effects.
Yeah, it was just wholesome, good fun. I've never seen E.T.
It has some dark elements, and it's like, wholesome, but like it's still 80s,
mm-hmm.
like proto, like super fucking 80s. But this is way different. Like, it's way different.
Yeah.
Like, if you're expecting like, oh, Amblin Entertainment, I can take my family to see it, just like, we know, E.T. made $1 billion. So they're like, yeah, we could do this. Gremlins, no. Gremlins might be a little harder to justify, I think. But no, this movie, it still holds up. I still love it. Like, I just love it. I think it's just one of those stories that it feels classic.
Gremlins?
Like, just absolutely to its core.
I mean, I think that has a lot to do with your
nostalgic attachment?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, I mean, it's a Christmas movie. I feel like
it's true. It is definitely a Christmas movie.
Yeah, for horror nerds. It really comes all together. And
it's not, like, so graphic that it, like, gets in the way of, like, your Christmas cheer.
No, definitely not.
You can watch it and, like, go do Christmas stuff after and not, like, have, like, a pit in your chest.
Yes, except I think the scene when the tree attacks, or not the tree, but the gremlin attacks the mom. And she...
Even that. I mean, that was, like, I was like, whoa, that's fucking cool.
Dude, but she's, like, murking these goddamn gremlins.
I know,
though.
God.
She is taking them.
She's
the
amazing.
Fuck out,
she's so smart. I'm just like, she's the hero of the fucking movie in this case. Like, again, she's the one. She took out the initial batch.
The whole batch.
Like, except for Stripe.
Mm-hmm.
And then Stripe decides to fucking cannonball into a pool thanks to fucking our genius hero here.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
Like, and then there's, like, a bajillion of them.
Yeah, then there's a flock of gremlins.
Then there's a flock of gremlins, mm-hmm. like a flock of seagulls.
Yeah.
To go with the 80s theme.
God.
But, no, the, like...
But she's getting her ass kicked, too, and she's still fighting. That's the best.
In the kitchen, like, she knocks three of them out, like, in within the span of, like, 30 seconds.
Fucking wielding a Michael Myers knife.
Yeah, and she, like, blends one, which is fucking
metal.
That was
good.
Metal.
That was so good.
Fuck. She stabs one to death like a fucking psychopath, and then she microwaves one with no hesitation whatsoever.
Mm-mm.
And then the other one, only the only reason that one was like it tricked her. That's the only reason that one got the upper hand. And then our fucking hero lops his fucking head off into the fire, which was a cool as shit shot, by the way, with his head and the fire and the flames. It was, and his whole thing, what's going on? Like the whole time, he's just like, "What the fuck is happening?" All she like, and then she does like that typical like mom thing where she's just like, "Get out of my kitchen!"
Yeah,
I'm like, I'm just like, "Mom, your kitchen is destroyed,"
and she's getting scratched up and beat the fuck
down. She has a fucking like cookie sheet like shield with the plates. Like she is like doing it. Like she is putting in work.
Seriously.
I am fired up about his mother.
She's a fucking gangster, dude.
Yeah, she's such a gangster.
Oh, and she could, you know, she could only do so much after that. She was beat down.
Yeah, she got fucked up, and then, like, the son was just like, okay, I'm gonna go, like, save the town and get, you know, kill the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And then he cannonballs into fucking
the community pool.
And then everyone's fucked, and it's all his fault, because he couldn't kill Stripe fast enough.
No, dude, if it was her, she's just like, whatever, dude, I'm on a roll right now. Yeah. Like, just take me to him.
Yeah.
Take me. Dude, Stripe would have bolted. He's like, oh, not this pool.
Exactly. Oh. So... anyway,
yeah.
Moving on. In your opinion, how do the special effects hold up compared to our 2019, almost 2020 standards?
Beats them.
Really?
Dude, okay, there's no CG effects that can capture. If they ever did this in CG, it'd be stupid. I'm sorry.
I couldn't imagine seeing these in CG just because, any CGI Gremlins just wouldn't look the same.
No,
there's
dude.
Something about the actors being able to organically interact with them being there.
Yeah.
That I think gives it a little special oomph, you
dude,
know?
Dude, seriously, like, the close-ups are good. They're mucusy, like, fucking putrid-looking fucking things.
When they're all moist-looking, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, that's such a hard effect to pull off. And they pull it off, like, masterfully.
Yeah.
And even, you know, if you haven't seen part two, but part two, they get to be in the daylight. Or, like, with, like, good lighting.
Ooh.
Yes.
Oh, so Joe Dante got his 5-year prep work for...
Oh, well, not quite. But again, we'll cover it when we cover it. but just the increase in special effects. Even then, that movie holds up from looks-wise today simply because they didn't have CG again to rely on. So, like, these creatures, like, their design... I think their design also helps sell them.
Yeah.
Like, their design's really solid. But overall, like, I'll take these special effects over any CG bullshit, live action, whatever it is, today. Like, if the new Lion King can just have all puppetry like this, that would be great.
Oh my gosh, that would take a lot.
It would take a long time, but I think it would look
cool.
I
think that would actually be a 5-year project.
That would totally be a 5-year project, for sure. But this one's for you, actually. Oh, well, first, actually, how do you think about these special effects? What do you think?
I mean, same thing.
Same
you
thing?
Did. Yeah,
yeah.
I completely agree with everything you said. I do think if, like, I will break the arms of whoever tries to, like, do a reboot of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Good thing I didn't put that in there, because I'm saving that news for next time we do Gremlins.
What?
It's been in talks.
No!
But it's been in talks with Spielberg.
No.
He wants to.
I don't care.
Yeah, we'll see.
Then we're going to get fucking CGI Gremlins.
No, but the thing is, it's been one of those things that's not been pushed forward that much.
Mm.
It's been like a development hell kind of thing.
Good. Yeah. Keep it there. I don't want it.
Yeah.
This is so good. Also, I just watched it. So
I know.
I'm just like, I don't need another one.
We'll save it for next year when we cover part two.
Ah!
And then we'll talk more about the potential reboot, should there be more news by the time it
comes
out.
I will break Steven Spielberg's arms.
Okay. You heard it here first, guys.
I'm coming for you, Spielberg, even though I just talked about how much I love you earlier.
I cannot be implicated as an accessory to this, just so you know. Anyways. But back to the 80s. What makes Gizmo so appealing? It's what do you think about him?
A cute Furby that doesn't have, like, the soul of Satan.
Before Furby, yes.
It's a pre-Furby.
Proto-Furby.
So cute.
But, like, cuter than any Furby.
Yeah.
Than any
Furby.
Furbies
scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, because they're not as organic and awesome looking
as
Gizmo.
No, they're robotic and terrifying. And, again, all of them are possessed by Satan.
All of them. Every single one of them.
Every single one of them are demonic.
I agree.
I fucking hate Furbies. They scare the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Gizmo's just cute as fuck. Like, come on, it's a little furry, like, and then kind of speaks English.
Dude, his voice is the shit. Howie Mandel fucking killed it, man.
He was not lying on his resume when he said he could do a child's voice. No, the... Yeah, he's just adorable. And then I was really bummed that he got taken away in the second, or at the end of the movie.
Oh, I know.
I was like, they're not going to let him stay.
Oh,
he didn't
dude.
Do anything.
Oh, you got to watch part two. But it has. No, I agree. There's something about Gizmo's design that's like timeless.
Oh, yeah.
Like it literally, like you, the Furbies obviously tried to emulate it, but even then they couldn't.
No.
They couldn't do it.
No.
Like it's just, he's just good.
He's just precious.
He's precious. Ah, yes. That's
just
the word.
Precious.
He's so fucking precious.
I just, and there's like the scene where the Kate is like, it's like she's like wrapped him up and like it's like mm-hmm. cradling him, and I'm like, wow, oh. Same dude. Like
I forgot about that. Yeah, that's cool. I love that. He's just so like you just want to take care of him.
Yeah,
and him. You want a Gizmo.
Yeah.
Like I want a Gizmo whenever I see him on screen. I'm like, dude, can I have that pet?
Yeah.
Like sentient motherfucker.
Yeah, like I would treasure and take care of and love and feed
my
not
little...
after midnight.
I want a pet just so I can name the pet Gizmo.
I think Gizmo's a really popular dog name actually.
Is it?
Yeah, for like tiny like I've seen
baby dogs.
I've seen like Pomeranians named Gizmo. But no, that's what makes Gizmo so appealing. You just want to like squeeze the life out
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, there's this adorable like organic looking nature tone and not like an uncanny valley thing.
No,
like
no.
The opposite. Like they actually created a creature that I want to exist now.
Yeah, they did an amazing job
mm-hmm.
for that. Yeah. So how does Gremlins compare to other horror comedies we've covered? Which way do you think it leans more towards on if you think of our spectrum?
On our spectrum? I'm going a little more horror on this one.
Really?
Like a slight bit more though. Like it's like right in the middle for me.
I was gonna say, I'm gonna call this like it's the true central. Like true neutral.
True neutral I can get behind. Because there are just too many elements working in here.
Yeah.
And that they work at all together is like brilliant.
Like the fact that there's like also like this whole other subplot of like the wacky inventor.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just think that's also like just great, wacky fun.
Oh dude, the dad's so cool. He's
yeah.
such a dad,
and
dad
he's
too.
Not like a dick. He's not
no.
like an asshole. He's not like a, you know.
Yeah. Well, him coming to the house, like him singing, and his family can hear him, and then they're like, "He's like, Dad's here."
Yeah, I'm and they're like happy to see him,
what
and like,
the fuck, dude.
I was just like, I'm just glad he. Because I was for a minute in the beginning, I'm like, he's not like an abusive twat,
no,
right?
No, not
like,
at all. He's
no. It's like I said, a functional, healthy family that loves each other. Like
dude.
I talked about that in the beginning. Like, how refreshing is that?
Right.
For an 80s like. You know, movie.
And then we get the mom fucking murking gremlins left and right.
Because she's
fighting for
badass.
Her life.
She's just, a badass. She is a bad bitch, okay?
That those two scenes can be in this film and it makes sense is a testament to just brilliant goddamn writing.
Yeah.
Chris Columbus and directing from Joe Dante. Like, that combo right there.
But yeah, so that's why I'm going to say it's like a good dead center.
It's right dead
like,
center.
You
yeah.
know, horror and comedy truly married in a fantastical way.
Dude, I was going to give it a little more horror, but you convinced me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm convinced right here. Totally center.
Well, for me, it just didn't have like the comedy out like very delicately balances and complements the horror elements to the point where I don't think I could confidently say there's more horror
mm-hmm.
or it's more of a horror film because then I think about the comedic elements and then
mm-hmm.
I think that there's, you know, it's too comedic for it to be more horror. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. And in terms of how does it compare to the other ones we covered, which is Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Yes.
I remember. There was
I think
one
we
more.
Did one more.
Shaun of the Dead.
Shaun of the Dead, yes.
I like it more than both of them, although I'll say Shaun of the Dead still has a very... they both have a special place in my heart, but they're
well,
both definitely more
well,
comedy.
Here's the thing. Yeah, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil holds a very special place in my heart because it was one of, like, the first ones, like, first, like, horror comedy type films that, like, lit me up
yes.
in a way that, like, really got me thinking about horror in, like,
mm-hmm.
a critical way.
Yeah, because it tackles the tropes.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's meta.
Yeah.
Very meta. And
so
yeah.
I think that is definitely a part of it.
Shaun of the Dead's like a tale of personal growth
yeah.
within a zombie movie.
Yeah.
Which is
so,
like a whole different type of vibe.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all different.
It's really hard for me to compare them, but I would say this, like, again, in the true neutral aspect of this, I would say that Gremlins is the, like, quintessential comedy horror film.
Yes, absolutely. It's right where the line is. It's
yeah.
the line.
Yeah.
It's the line for sure.
Definitely.
All right, so this one's for you. What makes Kate's story so effective? Or tell us about Kate's story for you.
I did not understand why this was in the film. I didn't get it. It was the, like, that was the one part of the movie that actually, like, took me out.
It's one of the very controversial parts of the film.
I just didn't understand why it was in there. Like, it just didn't need to be in the movie.
I always loved it.
I mean, I enjoyed the story. Like, that's my dilemma. That is my genuine dilemma, is I love the story because it's a fucked up story and it's a great fucking story. And I would watch a horror movie or, like, a short about that story.
Absolutely.
In a fucking heartbeat. Like, it's a fucking awesome story.
Yeah.
However, I just, like, this whole, like, they're like, getting attacked by gremlins, they're talking, and then, like, out of nowhere, it just, like, the lights dim more, she steps into, like, it just, like, soliloquy time, and, like, she just talks about her tragic backstory, and I'm like, what are you guys doing? You are on a mission.
It's Christmas.
I get that, but, like, it is not the time, nor is it the place.
I think it's, like, the break the film needed. I don't know why. For me, it is. Whenever it comes on, I, like, for some reason, it gripped me as a kid, for sure. Because, like, she tells it well, it's written well, and it's a story that's scary.
She delivers it perfectly.
Perfectly.
She delivers it very well. So I get that. It's just one of those things where I'm just like, I can't quite put my finger on why it takes me out, other than it just felt like wrong place, wrong time.
Mm-hmm. Like, and your logical brain is like, what are you doing?
I know, I'm like, because she had implied she hates Christmas earlier.
Yeah.
I get that, so I knew that there was, like, okay.
There's a reason,
Like, I'm like, okay, you had familial turmoil, you had whatever, you had some, like, I understand you don't like Christmas because of something in your past. I get that. I was able to pick up on that. Context clues, we're good. And then out of nowhere, she's just like, here's my whole tragic backstory, which is a fucking great story. So that's my own personal dilemma, is it's a fucking amazing story. I just don't know how wholly necessary it was.
What I love most about it, too, is, like, at the end of her telling it, she kind of has, like, a little baby laugh or, like, a little, like fucked
like
up, right?
Like,
which, like, again, as a kid, when you watch it, you're like, how am I supposed to feel about this?
Are you a psychopath?
Yeah, I don't know, but, like, I always loved it.
I don't remember why.
I can't quantify it.
The guy reacted.
I don't think it even went to his close-up. It did for, like, a second, and he's just, like, intrigued.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh, and then it, like, but that's the thing. There's no, like, reaction to it. They don't discuss it.
They cut away.
Yeah, they don't discuss it. They don't react. Like, she tells the story. We see a brief reaction. They move on to the next part, like, that's going on outside with, like, all the gremlins. Like, that's the only thing where, like, I think I was with it until they did nothing after it. I think that's the part where I was just like, okay, then this was for fucking nothing then?
Yeah.
Then I think that's the only thing that, like, kind of disappointed me was just, like, if they had done something with that, or if, like, if there was something, like, later in the movie where she had to crawl up a chimney.
Yeah, some plot element that makes sense.
Something that would have supplemented that, then I would have been like, okay, the story makes sense now. I understand. Mm-hmm. Like, then this is good. This is growth, plot development.
Interesting. I honestly like that it has nothing to do with it. It's a break.
It drives me nuts.
To me, it's perfect because it's like a kind of a little punch to the audience, and then back to regular scheduled programming.
Literally, all it is, like, it's literally like the movie, like, steps out of the movie, slaps you across the face a couple times,
steps back
into the movie and moves on like nothing happened. That is exactly what it did.
I love that. See, that's, I don't know why I like that, but maybe it's because, again, I've just known this movie since fucking forever.
I think you just love this movie so much that you fail to see any of its shortcomings.
Maybe, but it's like. See, well, that's the thing, though. Like, it's a divisive scene. But some people just love it. Some people don't.
It's not that I think that it shouldn't have been there. I think it's a great story. And I think it was, like, good to, like, flesh out her backstory a little bit.
Give her a little more meat, yeah.
But I think that they needed to do something else with it later in the plot. Like, again, I think there needed to be a scene where, like, something essential for the plot. She needed, like, Gizmo was stuck in a chimney and she needed to go up a chimney to get him. And, like, she had this
That would have been cool. But, I'm okay with it not mattering. Just to be honest with you. I just am. I like that it's almost, well, you'll love part two then.
Because
they go a little meta on it. Like, they go, like, a very funny, like a Dan Harmon Community kind of approach to Kate saying some shit.
Oh, I'm sure. But, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, like, I'm not that mad at it. Like, I'm not, you know, like, I don't think the movie is less of a movie because it's in there.
Yeah.
It was just like this, I mean, I think it was more of a personal preference where I was like, I wish you guys had done something more with it.
Yeah.
But they didn't, but that's fine. It was still a fucking metal as shit story. And again, if anyone knows of like any horror short or anything like that, like that encapsulates the story, I would love.
Oh, absolutely. Send it over.
And we're not talking about the story. But, like, if you have not seen Gremlins, go watch Gremlins. You'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Her tragic backstory is amazing.
It really is. But, again, it's doesn't go anywhere. And it's right smack dab in the middle of the action.
It's, like, in the middle of the third fucking, like...
Oh, yeah. Third act.
Third act. Like, it is in the middle. Like, shit. Like, I don't... Whatever. Okay. Moving on. So, why do you think Gremlins was such a huge hit, considering how controversial it was with critics and families of the time?
I think part of the controversy is what made it more appealing to, like, more people than who would go watch it.
Oh, yeah. Like, any movie, like, any Lars von Trier movie, people go see it strictly because it's Lars von Trier.
People hate this shit, man.
Yeah. Or just because, like, you know, they just know Lars von Trier is a controversial director.
Exactly.
So they're going to go see it because they want to be shocked, right?
Yeah,
so.
Definitely. I mean, it was also counter-programming against Ghostbusters, which... Families thought, like, oh, Ghostbusters has, like, monsters and stuff, so let's take them and watch this Christmas Gremlins movie.
So, your Gremlins is my Ghostbusters.
Interesting.
I've never not seen Ghostbusters. I fucking love Ghostbusters.
I mean, kind of same for me also, but at the same time, I always picked Gremlins over Ghostbusters, like, always.
Mm.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters is, like, my shit. I haven't watched it in, like, many, many, many years, but... I fucking loved Ghostbusters as a kid.
Sounds like we gotta put it on the list. Sounds like we gotta put it on the list.
It's on the list.
I mean, like, immediately, though. but yeah, I don't know. Like, to me, that aspect of it, and also it being an Amblin movie.
Yeah.
Like, people wanted to know what was gonna come after E.T. E.T. was a huge hit. So, like, in the context of the time, it had everything working for it to be a hit just that it had Spielberg's name. Sure, he hit the Twilight Zone shit. Like, that fucked it up a little bit, obviously.
So, they just decided, like, with this movie, they were just gonna take the, like, we're just gonna move it into the middle of the fucking summer to compete with the fact that
Nobody knows.
Hollywood industry is up Steven Spielberg's asshole.
Yeah, I think they just wanted to see how it... There was some reasoning that was like, oh, well, it would make more money in the summer, right? So, let's put it in the summer. But we're like, dude, it's a Christmas movie. And December has, like, not a lot of competition.
Right. I'm so surprised it did so well.
Seriously.
For a Christmas movie in the middle of the summer. I mean, we see, like, what they did with fucking Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, that's true. That's the opposite of this story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Go listen to Hocus Pocus about how that shit bombed and how it was even in the theaters.
Our 50th episode.
But, yeah, so the, I think for me...
Mm-hmm.
I wish I knew about how it was more controversial or how it was more of a huge hit, but I do think a lot of it did end up boiling down to people being like, and then one of them fucking exploded in a microwave.
Yeah.
You need to see it.
You need to see. That's a good point. They're like,
you know, like, or, you,
oh, I thought that was that movie about the gizmo and the little thingies.
I know,
right?
This cute little. I wish I had thought of this beforehand, but I wish I had watched the trailer for this.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that kind of gives you kind of context to what people were seeing before they saw it in theaters.
The way that they promoted it, actually, which I didn't put in the film, is...
I'm like, wow, you wrote on Gremlins,
I know,
huh?
Right? No, they actually had a trailer introducing the concept of Gremlins to the people.
Oh.
So it's like, these are Gremlins, this is Gizmos, these are the rules, blah, blah, blah. And, like, Amblin and all the other stuff. So people, like...
went into it knowing the rules and not knowing anything about the story.
Yeah, shit like that. So it was like, people were clearly guided to it, which, I mean, obviously got an audience. And then Spielberg's name, of course, at the time. And, I mean, controversy sells. So controversy on this, controversy on Spielberg himself at the time.
Yeah.
People had to know what was up and if what he was doing was still going to be good, or is it like shit Spielberg now?
An appropriate level of controversy, because we'll see in Twilight Zone the movie, that's too much controversy.
Too much. That obviously did not help that movie at all.
Tanked the movie.
Yep, pretty bad. Pretty bad. Ugh. Anyways, how do you feel about the characterizations of the Gremlins themselves?
Oh, I loved it.
Dude, they're the best.
I feel so bad because I feel like I need to rewatch it and be like, are they racist?
Oh, see, I didn't get that at all. But then again, I've known it since I was younger anyway, so whatever. And then, but like...
But also, like, I'm just like, they weren't, like, seeking out fried chicken.
No, it was given to them.
It was given to them.
Yeah. And, like, all the, like, you know, listening to whatever black music that people were, you know, black with, music, quote, quote.
I know. I'm just, quotes are so heavy in this. I'm just like, I don't understand.
I just thought they were cool. Like, yeah. They were cool. Like, they're smoking cigars and shit and dressing, like, fucking awesome, like, dapper and, like chilling.
Yeah.
They were cool.
I didn't, that was the one thing where, when I read that in the outline, I was just like, oh, no, are they racist? Do I need to rewatch it? Are they racist?
To be fair, the controversy is not as highly blown now. I think people, like, kind of got over it. But at the time, it was like, what's going on here? Blah, 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 like that kind of thing.
I guess, but, like, oh, my gosh. I just thought the Gremlin, like, the Gremlin character designs were cool as shit.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like how they all kind of had, like, distinct personalities.
They did.
And how, like, they
That one that laughs. Fucking hit, like,
yeah,
like
their little chittery laugh is just very funny.
The one, but there's one with, like, big fucking eyes. It was the most annoying laugh.
Yeah,
and he just gets me every time. He actually keeps me out. I don't know why.
Interesting.
Yeah, of all of them,
Stripe. I was just like, as like the big bad. I'm like, you're kind of creepy,
dude. Oh, Stripe's death though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that brings us into the next question. So, What's your kill of the film?
Stripe's fucking death. Stripe's death. It was actually one of the few scenes as a kid where I was like, oh, shit. Like,
I think that's going to be my top honorable mention. But I think I have to say the gremlin who got put in, like, the fucking blender.
Yeah.
Because that's when I was like, oh, that's the type of movie this is going to be.
Yep.
Because that's, like, the first, like, really graphic death where I was like, oh.
Oh, they're showing it.
Oh, they're showing this? Mm-hmm. Really? And that's kind of, so that was kind of like that first, like, I was taken aback.
Dude, and it escalates because then she shanks the fuck Michael Myers style out of it. She goes Norman Bates on this motherfucker.
Yeah.
And then microwaves another one. Like, it's like this whole thing.
So I think that's,
That's yours, Blender?
Yeah, the Blender Gremlin.
No, that makes sense. I would say Spike just because it's so drawn out.
And Spike's my Stripe.
Yeah, Spike.
Stripe's my honorable mention. Mm-hmm. Because of that death was just intense as hell.
Dude, so. And the special effects were hot for it.
They did a great job on that. Like, and then just him melting and then him popping out and skeleton. And I was just like, oh my God, this is gruesome. So, which sucks because it's just like, that's the one time we get to see a gremlin in the sunlight. And now I know in the second one, they can be in the fucking sunlight.
Well, it's weird. The lighting in the film itself is just a lot better. But there are scenes in the sunlight too. And, well, I don't know. You'll see.
We'll get into it. We'll talk about it.
Again, it's way different.
We'll talk about it later. Eventually, we'll talk about it.
Absolutely.
So that's your kill of the film.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Stripe for sure. Honorable mention. Blender probably, but also Microwave Boy.
Microwave is also an honorable mention sure. Because that one, I was just like, wow, that is fucked up.
Dude, they kept escalating. That shit's awesome. Oh, man. All right.
Last question.
What is it? Hit me.
What would you rate this film out of 5 Mogwai corpses?
Giving it a 5.
Yeah?
This is my 5.
This is going to be a 4.5 for me.
4.5.
4.5 Mogwai corpses.
I will take it. You know, whatever Phoebe Cates fucking story I get. This is, to me, it, again, I've noticed since I've known movies, I hadn't seen it in a long time. It brought everything back, and I just love this movie to its core.
Yeah. My cat looked like Batman for a second.
Oh, she
like
did.
Staring,
she totally did.
And I was just like, what are you doing, you little... Anyway. But no, 4.5. It's a really good movie. It's well done. The story's fun. It's a quick little hour 45 movie.
Yeah,
like,
it's long.
And it's festive. It's a good Christmas movie. It's a fun time.
Absolutely. No, I'm okay with that rating. Yeah. I accept it.
So I think is there anything else you would like to mention about the movie? Any praises you'd like to sing?
No, just that, hey, if you guys listen to this whole episode, you know, and you still hadn't seen the movie, and you're not like, you know, we have fans that like don't actually watch horror movies, but like hearing us talk about it for some reason.
Yes.
I say you can actually take the time to sit back and watch this Christmas movie. Just know that it does get pretty graphic. But
it's 80s graphic.
It's special effects graphic. It's not like...
It's not bloody.
There's some blood.
It's graphic, but it's not bloody.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like a splatter film.
No.
Unless you're a fucking gremlin.
I would recommend it. Yeah, definitely check it out. I cannot wait to hear what you guys think about it. I loved it. Anthony, of course, naturally loves it. So I'm
part of
very...
my heart.
Yeah, so... This was really fun. I'm really glad we got to talk about this. This is a fun little Christmas horror comedy flick.
Absolutely. And, saying it right now, see you next year for Gremlins 2.
Gremlins 2. We'll make
maybe
it work.
Maybe Krampus.
We'll see. Not to spoil too much. I mean, it's like half the month already. Actually, yeah. Most of the month, not including Cronenberg Christmas.
Oh, that's right. Cronenberg. Okay, cool.
So that's like, now you know like most now of the programming the yeah, for the next for next December.
You got plenty of episodes until then, though, including next week's episode.
Yeah, next week's episode. We are going back to Aliens. We've taken a break. I haven't talked about Aliens since July, yep. So it has been a cool minute. So I'm very excited to talk about them again.
Oh, dude. I haven't seen this one.
So this is a fun one. It's very, like, unsettling, especially if you're anything like me and have fears of being abducted by aliens. So this is a fun one. It's also rooted slightly in true quote-unquote experiences, so okay. We will talk about that as well. I'm very excited. I think Anthony will enjoy it and have moderate to severe nightmares, so
okay, cool.
I will ask his thoughts when we talk about that next week, so make sure you join us for that next week on the Horrible People's Podcast. This was 1984's Gremlins.
El Gremlins.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. It means the world to us. It helps keep us up in the charts, and it also helps with our visibility on iTunes. So please, 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 if you have not done that, it just takes a second, and it helps out so much.
Absolutely.
And then also, if you want to stay up to date on all of the cool stuff going on, we try to stay pretty active on social media with extras from the episodes, so stuff that we might have talked about here, we supplement on social media. Mm-hmm. So you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Horror People Pod. And then you can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast. And then if you want to see anything Anthony's up to in his day-to-day,
yay.
You can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. And then if you want to stay up to date with me, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop. And I think that'll go ahead and close us out for the week. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. And until then, don't feed any gremlins after midnight.
Or myself. Peace out.
Bye, guys.
Bye.